Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you first saw this house, you saw an orange tree, and you thought, my California dream is...
My California dream has arrived.
It is?
Yeah,
but
it is.
You are now carrying a bag full of...
Yeah, I have a bag full of orange juice, so we can make juice, and it's like, you know, airborne OG. Have you read John Fante's Ask the Dust?
No.
This is kind of a seminal LA book, and he talks about how, you know, oranges is the symbol of LA and how beautiful and juicy and delicious and sweet they are. But if all you eat is oranges, your stomach gets bitter and sour, you know?
I see the metaphor there.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good book. It's about a failed writer, so I feel a lot of kinship and his struggles.
Los Angeles is a place that is too big, too deep, spread way too thin under the marine layer and above the concrete culverts to give you, the visitor, any idea of what the hell is really going on. I didn't know that the first half dozen or so times that I came, and I didn't understand the place at all. If I've learned anything in the decades since, it's that you need your people, the ones who have found their place in the basin. And they can bring you along and communicate their vision of what Los Angeles really is. So now, I've got JR in Manhattan Beach, Mike in West Hollywood, Yukio in South Central, and increasingly Carolina Miranda, my former colleague at Time Magazine, for everything east of the 110. In the next few weeks, you'll meet some of these people, my people, in Los Angeles, and I couldn't be happier starting here in East LA with Carolina. She's a deeply influential writer, culture hawk, and collective bargainer at the resurgent Los Angeles Times. We're drinking some juice from her front yard, spiked with Prosecco, and talking about porn theaters, old school donut shops, and what Latinos in the Southland have to teach us all. I'm Nathan Thornburg, and from Luminary Media, this is The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world.
What we can do is, well, let me just put these into rinse. If you want juice, I can make juice, but we'll just make juice out of the ones that have already been washed.
Yeah. Let's do it. Now, how much is this going to sound like just peeing on tape?
I know, exactly. You could sell it to a Hollywood sound guy. It's like his archive of sounds. I need the sound of peeing for a Pedro Almodovar movie. Okay, hold on. I think we got it.
And that's it. So what are we? We'll just do straight shots.
We could make mimosas.
Is it mimosa time?
I have one of these mini bottles of Prosecco.
All right, that's perfect.
Let's do this.
Little one-offs of La Marca Prosecco with East LA
orange juice.
Orange juice.
Anyway, welcome to L.A.
You and I were working in New York, but you're from out here. You're from Southern California.
Yes, I grew up here.
You came back for the drink that we're drinking this morning.
I came back because I like sunshine and burritos, and New York is terrible on either front. The burrito game is a sad game in New York City. And so, no, I'd been wanting to come back for a long time, partly because I don't like winter, and then partly because I just see a lot of bad writing about LA. And I remember being in New York, and I would read all these stories about LA and always thinking, you know, I think I could do this better. You know, why do I read all this crap? And so that was part of what motivated me to come back. That, the sunshine, the orange juice, the burritos.
There's a side of reading you on social media, especially, that I enjoy, which doesn't come that often. But when it comes, it's full-throated. And that's the takedown of the incredibly tone-deaf vacuous New York Times Southern California piece.
Yeah. Which, usually in the style section.
Yeah.
It's like the law.
They fly somebody out to fuck it up exactly. And then go back home.
Let's drop this guy in Beverly Hills and arm him with every LA trope. You know, nobody walks. There's no culture here. Or the culture only just landed here. Everyone drinks pressed juice and like eats kale. We are drinking pressed juice, but please note that it has alcohol in it.
There you go.
You know, it's just every stereotype about Los Angeles. There was a story recently, like nobody eats bread in LA. And I'm, you know, of course, like every Latino in Los Angeles was like flinging bolillos at the New York Times online or the equivalent, you know, saying what the hell are, like, what do you mean by everybody? Because everybody always means like the Bermuda Triangle around Beverly Hills and none of the other communities that actually comprise the majority of Los Angeles.
Right. And where panaderias are one of the three staple businesses.
Exactly.
Of it's like most of LA.
The taco truck, the panaderia, and the gas station and car wash / weed dispensary.
Right. So LA is evolving. But yeah, I mean, that, like you're saying, there was a personal element too of just feeling like you want a house with an orange tree.
Yes.
And here we are drinking orange juice from your own orange tree in your house in East LA. And this is what haunts New Yorkers who have tasted Los Angeles on some level, is that it actually happens. It's actually possible.
You know, I just consider myself really lucky. Like, I kind of can't believe it happened. When we first moved here, we're living in this tiny, leaky apartment a few blocks away from here that had great views of downtown, but that, as a living space, was limited in its range. So we did put in our time in the less idyllic corners of Los Angeles.
Well, and one of the things that is also kind of catching up with you, I guess, and this is going to probably sound like a call to gentrification, which I suppose it is because, you know, I'm one of the four horsemen of the gentrification apocalypse, I'm mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah, I cover art, so.
Right.
I'm pretty much, I spend a lot of time thinking about that.
But East LA is fucking great.
Yes.
You know, I'd been coming here for a very long time because, you know, 26 years ago, I started dating the woman I'm with and her family's from East LA, her mom's mm-hmm. side of the family. But I'd also, you know, just like being with the family and spending the time, you remember the heat and the traffic and the, mm-hmm. you know, all of those things. What I've realized now that I've grown up about East LA is that it makes West LA look like, I don't know, like a Stepford city. I mean, you represent.
I don't know. I don't want to completely rag on West LA. Yeah. There's, you know, like the Sawtelle area, which is super Japanese and has amazing food and there's some good stuff.
There is some good stuff. And you diplomatically represent the entire Southland in the arts and culture scene. So I'll just say it kind of fucked with us because we had always thought, like, if you moved to LA, you had to be at least around the 405, you know, since you get like that marine layered cool off, you get that good breeze, you know,
yeah,
something. And now it's like, it's impossible to think about living anywhere except out here where the food is great and where yeah. people are still just living and it's not.
I mean, part of it is LA, the west side of LA has become increasingly unaffordable. Like these pockets on the west side that used to be affordable, areas like Palms, parts of Venice, stretches of Santa Monica in along Pico. When I was growing up, you know, Santa Monica was not the sort of $10 juiced republic that it is today. It, you know, had a lot of working class. It was the People's Republic of Santa Monica. There were some crunchy food co-ops and a dead mall. You know, it wasn't what it is today. And I think, you know, LA's booming development
yeah.
has displaced these spaces that a lot of working class people used to inhabit. And so as a result, everybody's moving east, putting a lot of pressure on, you know, Latino families on the east side.
Right. Because there is, I mean, Santa Monica used to have like a really bitchin' and well-developed Oaxacan basketball league and the yeah. public parks out there and stuff. That would not happen today, I imagine. I haven't
yeah,
gone
to it'd be
check,
harder.
But
you probably have folks that are there from those days. But yeah, it'd be very difficult to land in LA now and just move to Santa Monica unless you are a trustafarian or some well-remunerated tech person.
So you moved here to the east side a few years ago, and part of your exploration of LA and being back here has been through food. So tell me about your mission based.
My missions.
Your missions.
I have many missions. Yeah, it's been interesting. We moved around a lot in LA and the Southern California area growing up. So I spent part of my youth in the Valley, which is a great site for food in the San Fernando Valley. And then I went to high school in Orange County in a neighborhood that is super Asian. So just ate lots of great Chinese and Japanese and Korean food. I've always come back to LA a lot. And in fact, my father was sick for a while when he was dying of brain cancer. I spent a lot of time here helping care for him. And I think that was part of what inspired me to move back too, of spending so much time here. I was here for like months at a time. Being like reminded that it's like, oh, I don't have to live in a little sweatbox in New York. Like I can come back here and be here and I can actually write about this place as somebody who is knowledgeable about it. And the food is great and it's cheap. And the great thing about Los Angeles is something that I think Jonathan Gold articulated so beautifully in his writing was that, you know, some of the most amazing things you find in that like anonymous strip mall, in the truck, in the little hot dog stand, you know, that LA does working class food really well. And local food and neighborhood food and that food that nourishes and that isn't about posting it to Instagram. And so I've been on these like bizarre little missions. So one of my missions now that I just started is to eat at, and this is an architectural slash food mission, is to eat at every donut stand that has a giant donut as part of the architecture. So, you know, Randy's by the airport on Manchester, which is famous. Right. Dale's.
You can't get from the airport headed north without
driving by Randy's.
Giant fucking donut. How many feet? I don't know.
It's 20. Probably like, yeah, it's big. They recently painted it like yellow in honor of the Rams at the Super Bowl. And there was this like mild horror that went through LA briefly. Like, is somebody fucking with the Randy's donut? How dare anybody like touch the Randy's donut? It's like somebody call the LA Conservancy.
What is that even supposed to be? Is that like a lemon curd donut or yeah, something?
Exactly. It made no sense. So the Randy's donut, Dale's donut, there's the donut hole in La Puente. There's other big donuts. Because I work near the airport, I started Randy's and now I'm starting to work my way east.
What are they going to have in common? Are they all like kind of a certain era? Like
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. They are from this era when LA was just full of programmatic architecture. You know, if you think of the Brown Derby being some of its most famous. So there's the bar in North Hollywood that is in a barrel. In the back, they have what used to be, I think, a hot dog stand that's a little dog. And so all of this architecture that kind of signaled what it was about, like that was such a huge thing in Los Angeles. And actually, if you watch like old films of Los Angeles, it was bonkers. There was like buildings that looked like the Sphinx and, you know, like everything in all kinds of shapes. And so I feel like it kind of harkens to this era of complete ebullience and freedom. And yeah, I'm going to build a thing in the shape of a derby or a donut because I can, and I'm not going to have some like New York types going, oh my God, you can't do that. LA really was this place, especially in the early 20th century, where like anything went architecturally, anything went in terms of film. I mean, that was when the film industry was really taking off here. And so I think that architecture for me symbolizes that era. Just, we're going to come here and break some trademark rules and make movies.
And damn your zoning laws to hell.
Exactly.
It is, and it's so amazing because you're right, like the role of LA in our national culture of telling New York to lighten the fuck up is huge and hugely important, which is probably all the condescension that kind of, you know, drips off the style section of the New York Times is probably in conversation with that legacy. But you know, I've got this coffee table book about all the disappearing storefronts and signages in New York that is crazy because you go through there and the rate of extinction has increased since I even got the book. You can barely find any of the ones that are there in there. LA is still a place where you can go and, you know, right across from my wife's house in Culver City, the Tattletale Lounge is still a stinky ass, fantastic dive bar with original signage, like wildly inventive, like kind of like, you know, hot dog on a stick meets, you know, Bukowski, you know, glory hole. And it's just like,
I can smell it from here.
It's so original. It hasn't been redeveloped or like condemned or any of the things that maybe might've should have happened.
Yeah.
And it's still there and it's amazing. And it's right next to a gun shop and LA is just still living, you know?
Yeah, it still has. Somebody once told me that LA always has at least one of something that has gone extinct elsewhere. So, like, for example, I did a story a few years back on how LA's last two porn theaters, many cities don't have porn theaters anymore at all. And in fact, I think the last one in New York was just sold and doesn't screen movies anymore, if I'm correct. You know, it's this thing where in the age of the internet, you don't need to go to a porn theater, you can download it. And yet in LA, there are these two theaters where you can go and watch porn. And, you know, they really speak to the city where there is the space for these things to continue to survive. So yeah, the programmatic architecture. The other thing I'm on a mission for is my husband and I, every anniversary, we go and eat at an old-timey steakhouse. So nice. The Del Rey in Pico Rivera. I don't know if you've ever been there.
I have not.
It's just like, you know, a piece of the 40s or 50s with this bizarre 80s bar. Like, they attach this like 80s bar to it. That's a little, like, doesn't make sense architecturally, but whatevs. But it is one of those places where you go get your great steak and your iceberg wedge, and the waiters all look like they've been there since the place opened, you know, and they have the Googie sign with neon, and it's just like this other sliver of Los Angeles. You know, if the programmatic architecture speaks to this ebullience of this earlier era, these steakhouses are kind of these modernist, post-war, booming LA. Everyone's moving here. Aerospace is here. A lot of them speak to that era. And but, you know, they go evolving too. Like the one we went to last time, Stevens, is it's like wedged next to the 5 freeway where Commerce meets East LA meets Downey. And it has this kind of like whole Italian decor motif going on inside with, like, you know, visions of Tuscany. It's this like old-timey steakhouse. The food is not that good. But the night that we were there to celebrate our anniversary was also cumbia night. And then next door, there was like some Latin band playing. And so everybody in their catering area. And so it's this steakhouse that still exists largely in the form it always has and is, I imagine, serving the menu it always has. Yet it has been completely taken over by Latino immigrants in the sense of, like, they have made it their own. And it's really great to see. It's like kind of great to be at this old Italian, old school steakhouse and then go dance cumbia, like, next to the bar.
That sort of old bottle, new wine thing strikes me as like super LA too. Yeah. One of the things that always blew me away, because my wife's family's Mexican from East LA and her father's family is, you know, Japanese American from Gardena, South Central area. Everybody lived in the same shitty houses, you know, like the little ranch house with the small yard and the chain link fence. But when you went inside each of these houses, it was like transporting. You were in a completely different culture.
Yes.
You know, definitely plastic on the sofa in East LA.
God bless. Yeah.
Yeah. The little side yard was a rock garden in Gardena. The gods hanging out in the garden and on the walls are different. The architecture is the same. The style of living, the basin that everybody shares, exactly the same, but wildly different.
Everyone makes inside. It their own flavor. Like, everyone takes it and makes it their own flavor. One of my favorite places to go, and again, the food's not that good, but I just like to go because it's so symbolic, is this place in Alhambra called Noodle World. It's this, like, chain, I think it's a local chain of Asian noodle houses that's, like, pan-Asian. Like, they serve, you know, you can get a pad thai, you can get Chinese noodles, you can get, and none of them are that great. But the one in Alhambra occupies a former Bob's Big Boy that still has the Big Boy in the dining room. So it's kind of this husk of Americana that was dying, and then immigrants came in and rejuvenated it and made it their own. And you go in there and it's Latinos and Asians eating pan-Asian noodles inside Bob's Big Boy with Bob still watching. Like, it's just this completely amazing testament to, you know, how immigrants can kind of invigorate old symbols. I think of Koreatown. Koreatown is a perfect example of this. It's this part of the city that had really kind of been affected by white flight in the 1960s, and Korean immigrants came in. And a reason a lot of, I think, the incredible architecture in that neighborhood has survived was because people kind of came in and took it over, but kind of kept it as is. They didn't come in and redevelop these buildings. They just used them as is.
Right. They just put some karaoke
Yeah, rooms or in a spa or a yeah. good restaurant or, you know, a place with bottle service. I mean, you name it, fried chicken. But what is really a treasure of a neighborhood has been in large part preserved by Korean immigrants.
Right. So that process, I guess, is giving LA a lot of its juice right now. I don't know. It's so stupid to say, like, LA is having a moment. LA's been here.
LA has been here all along. It has its moments. Like every city, it goes up and down. I mean, the 90s were not a good time here. Between the civil unrest in 1992, the riots, and followed by the Northridge earthquake, it was a period when a lot of people wanted to give up on LA.
Yeah.
And then, you know, followed by various financial crises, things did not look good for Los Angeles. But, you know, it has come through and it's booming. And I think certainly part of it has to do with its position. I think people love to talk about Hollywood, but LA has the biggest shipping container port in the Western Hemisphere. Manufacturing is still a huge part of what gets done here.
Yeah, San Pedro is like...
Yeah, you go to San Pedro, which a lot of these parachute reporters probably never do, or they only fly over it. And it's just like, you are looking at industrial scale commerce, like writ on the land.
Yeah.
You know, it's intense.
They have a Japanese diner in San Pedro that's been there since like 1900 something.
Oh my god, I need to add that to my list of things to do.
It's such a trip, and I think it's still in the family. And it's one of those things, sound like you're saying, with the nightclub, where the neighborhood has definitely
changed
around it. But yeah, it's still plugging on. And anyway, it's just, you see that this city is, it's got just like 1,000 universes mm-hmm. inside of it. And one of the things that I admire about the writing you do is always kind of finding ways of talking about it that are both new, but kind of respect what's out there and giving it a different perspective. And that, certainly this essay you just wrote for Guernica, although you are, you know, your staff at LA Times, they let you out to like,
yeah,
think big and crazy outside.
Yeah,
your beat.
That was a piece that had actually been in the work for many years.
Yeah,
I had two things that were outstanding from my pre-LA Times life. The other one is an artist monograph that I'm running 4 years late on, and slightly embarrassed to admit.
Well, shit,
we won't talk about that now.
You got a busy job.
But the Guernica story, yeah, it was really about reframing Los Angeles. I mean, as the daughter of South American immigrants, this whole idea of LA as West was not, it just wasn't my reality. Like, I recognize that it's part of the history of what this is, of what California is, westward expansion, manifest destiny, the crossing. You know, Joan Didion has written about it quite remarkably, but it wasn't my reality, and it wasn't the reality of most of the people I grew up with who are Latino and Asian, for whom LA is North and is East.
So, and it's North for people coming from Latin America
and it's East
for Asians who are coming to find themselves through a very different kind of
exactly. And path. It has these long traditions of Asian immigration. I mean, there were Chinese immigrants in Los Angeles in the first census when California became part of the Union in 1850. Mexicans and Asians have been part of Los Angeles. Well, Mexicans, obviously, this was a city founded by Mexicans. But, you know, I'm talking about like that mix of people has been from the day California joined the Union. That has been Los Angeles. And so this long running Chinese immigration that began with the railroads and the gold rush, followed by a huge Japanese immigration, followed by Vietnamese immigration, followed by Korean immigrations, these like constantly replenished waves of Asian and Latino immigration, certainly Mexican over the decades, but followed by Central Americans and Peruvians.
So your Chino Latino story of LA
yes.
is really just about reframing the axis, and it's not about East Coasters coming West.
Yeah, exactly. And I think so much of it, and the problem with the East-West narrative is it always puts LA within the context of only the U.S. You know, it starts with the landing of the colonists in Virginia and slowly progresses west until you hit the Pacific Ocean, and that's where your California dream dies. You know, like manifest destiny goes skidding into the ocean, and then that's it. You're done. And it completely ignores, A, everything that was here before any of that happened, that this did used to be Mexico, and that this is a very different type of place with a very different type of architecture that may not be familiar to East Coasters, but that is very familiar if you come from Mexico or Santiago. I mean, Santiago, Chile, topographically, looks exactly like Los Angeles, down to the smog. You know,
like Mediterranean climate.
Mediterranean climate. It's one of the seven Mediterranean zones in the world, LA and Santiago, Chile. So for my mother, this was this very like familiar landscape. Whereas to East Coasters, it was kind of this fantastical, you know, desert with oranges and cactus. And I think when you look at it differently, you see the city very differently and you see the forces that shape it very differently. You see the ways in which Asian design have influenced the architecture and landscape. You know, you can drive through Los Angeles and look at the gardens and tell where Japanese families had lived by the landscape design. The bushes trimmed into these like charming shapes and arranged.
Yeah.
You know, with this balance and symmetry, you can drive through a neighborhood and see the influences, obviously, of Spanish colonial and Mexican architecture. You can see all of these things written sort of into the face of the city. But when we only look at it as West, what do you see? You see filmmaking, you see railroad, you see the Dust Bowl migrants, you see a million Iowans moving out here, but it kind of erases everything else. So that was something I really wanted to think about. Let's reframe.
Yeah. You know,
I'm tired of reacting to that debate. Let's reframe it.
Right. And more often than I probably would like, I'm down here to have meetings in that other LA about film or television. You know, this is a lot of what we were doing with Tony, and you forget how obnoxious that culture is of like incredible meetings and kind of vapid.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just selling everybody out that vapid people. No, some of them I'm sure are fine, but it's like that LA does exist.
And it does.
And it really does. I think this is probably just having the great privilege of getting to walk around and find food with you here. But that's the way that I think this town expresses itself for outsiders who don't understand the polarity that you're talking about and all this. Like,
yeah.
That's how they can get it. And you had worked with Jonathan. You knew him personally. And Jonathan Gold was the poet of all of this stuff. What did you learn from him about LA and about eating in LA?
I think, you know, one of the things, it's hard to sum up what I learned from him because he was just so enormously influential. I think part of it is meeting LA on its own terms, understanding that, you know, East Coasters come out here and kind of freak out that the city doesn't have a center. It doesn't have a center. Yeah, and that can be a little annoying sometimes when you want to do a bunch of things all at once because you got to sort of scoot all over town and sit in traffic. But I think part of not having a center means that there are lots of centers. And I think that's something that Jonathan understood innately as a writer and as a reporter, that there are lots of centers and those centers revolve around different ideas and different people and different communities of immigrants, and you meet them on their own terms. I think one of the things that makes LA so different from New York is I feel like everybody moves to New York and ultimately becomes a New Yorker. People who move to LA ultimately become more a part of the neighborhood that they move to than this greater idea of LA. Like, what is an Angeleno? It's
right.
Like, well, an Angeleno is some yoga girl from the West Side. It is also, you know, Mexican immigrants on the East Side. And it's like Long Beach car dudes that speak English like they're speaking Spanish but are white. Or the generations of African Americans that have lived in South LA, like areas like Leimert Park. I mean, all of that is Los Angeles. There is no like this one single identity. And I feel like Jonathan, he really understood that, and I think through food made us understand that LA really is this place that you have to go to. You have to make the effort to get to know. It's never going to come to you. Like, you're going to have to go to the Indian restaurant in Artesia that's way out of your way to go have this experience. That place is not just going to come open randomly in your neighborhood, because part of what that restaurant in Artesia is doing is serving a whole Indian community. That the little Tijuana, you know, chicken neck taco stand is parked in Boyle Heights for a reason. And I think he had such a great understanding of that and was able to bring people together through food in a way that I don't think really any other writer has.
Well, when you were saying, you know, that Angelenos have all these distinct identities, one thing that does seem unifying is that they are all held hostage in their neighborhood by the traffic.
Yeah. Yeah, that binds us, the traffic binds us together.
And you're right, it is this kind of, you have to make the effort.
And I think that's part of LA too, the whole journey is the destination. I think growing up here, one of the things I understand innately is like sometimes you'd be hanging out with a friend And you might spend a day running errands with them, but you'd be hanging out with them. So you'd be in the car and then you'd go to the drugstore and you'd get something, you'd get back in the car and then you'd go somewhere else. And the day was spent kind of in like movement. And I remember doing that with some out of town friends. Like when I first moved back, I was like, hey, I got all these things to do. Why don't you come with? And they kept expecting like, okay, when are we going to arrive at the place we're going to? And I was like, we're going from one place to the next. I got shit to do and you're coming with me and this is how we hang out.
The image that I have of Jonathan Gold is his truck.
Yes. And like tooling around.
That was his thing, was he was going to blast through all of these walls of traffic by, you know, and I remember, I think it, Matt who said that he actually insisted on picking Matt up in the truck. And they would go do the thing because that was the full experience for him.
Exactly. And I think Angelinos really understand that. Jonathan wanting to get Matt into his truck. It wasn't just about meeting in the restaurant. It was about the whole exchange that goes on prior to you getting there and sitting in traffic and having this conversation and knowing that being in a state of movement is just part of being here.
Yeah.
Being in a state of standing still, really, because traffic doesn't move that much.
Right. Jonathan Gold, you've had this problem, and I guess the LA Times had this problem. It's like, how do you replace a guy like that? Which was, you know, what I don't know. When
you can't.
You can't.
It's like trying to replace Tony. Like, they are such, not just larger than life, but with such a distinct world view. That to come in and have somebody try to just occupy that worldview would feel a little bit like an occupation.
Yeah, we've been joking about, you know, it's like we were joking with Kamau about, you know, somebody just tossing a CBGB t-shirt at the next anchor.
Yeah, being like, you're Tony.
Yeah, right.
That like would be terrifying.
You couldn't give an old beater truck to a, you know, Jewish music savant with a huge appetite and say like, great, let's make it happen. This is now almost exactly a year to when we came and shot with Bourdain in LA for this little LA series. We did six of them. They were kind of like ethnic enclaves, little profiles. And I remember Tony, one of his notes was like, we have to say Jonathan Gold country somewhere in here.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have said it in every episode on every minute. I think he chose the Armenian episode where we went to Little Armenia and had their basturma. But yeah, it's just like, you know, eating in LA is just, it was the way to do it right was the Jonathan Gold way. I have to say, though, you know, not to put shoes on anybody because it has been a platoon that's come in to the Times to sort of take over and reinvigorate the food section in particular, but where you brought Tony for that series at Six and Bonnie Bray.
Yes.
Was just
Little
like
Guatemala.
Little Guatemala was just like, it was pretty fucking Goldian, you know?
Yes.
you are not he and he not you and so on. But it was still just this incredible, almost like a strip mall on the sidewalk of vendors who cook out of shopping carts and create incredible food.
And that's where LA is great, is that the sprawl allows these little micro communities to emerge, that, you know, you can be tooling around Los Angeles and come to this corner where there's all of a sudden like 30 Guatemalan food vendors, and then you keep driving and you hit downtown, you know,
right.
Like it's just
and that it was also Six and Bonnie Bray, as you were pointing out in the video with Tony, used to be like this kind of shishi place that you know,
in the early 20th century,
the urban elite of Los Angeles, and always in transition. One of the things that you had brought up there too was about licensing for street vendors and the conflict that the city had of not wanting to, you know, put these people already at risk in, you know, states of violation of the law, particularly in Trump times. What's been happening in LA around that?
They finally passed a law that legalized street vending. It's hilarious because LA is known for its street vending and it's essentially been illegal forever. Most of the time people look the other way, but there have been, you know, there are raids every once in a while. And so it was finally legalized, I believe, last year. I think part of what they are determining now is they now need to figure out the bureaucracy that will govern this. So if you have a cart, what kind of license will govern that cart? Will there be health inspections? Essentially, how is this going to be managed at the level of government? So that's being determined right now. And I'm sure, knowing the way the LA City Council works,
Yeah.
It'll be a while before any of that is figured out. So in the meantime, we operate in this kind of in-between space, which is kind of how LA operates all the time.
Nobody's too deeply uncomfortable with it.
No.
I did notice this ridiculously good dinner you took me to last night where I got, you know, like huitlacoche taco and mole poblano. And I mean, just absurdly good.
Yeah.
Chicharron taco.
That is the best chicharron taco on the planet.
They had a little sign. It was like, it had a health, like, inspection sign. And they also had, like, running water in a sink. And, you know, like, there
the
was...
The trucks often do. I think the street vending mainly affects folks who are selling out of carts.
Right.
And so,
the people
like,
who have cooked tamales at home.
At home, or the donuts. Like, I once did a story for Lucky Peach about the donut luchador, this guy who used to make donuts in his home.
Great
and
story.
And then go and sell them on the street. And then it turned out that at night he did Mexican lucha. Lucha Libre. That was a great story. And so I think it affects that kind of trade. And then the city council is looking at rules right now to make people also catering out of their homes, small scale catering, because that is a huge livelihood for immigrants here. People being able to make tamales in their home and maybe like take some orders through Facebook and sell them. But because they're not licensed, because occasionally there are crackdowns on homemade food. And so they're looking at that because that is a very important source of income for immigrants and for women too, who tend to be the ones who do that. And by it being illegal, you just remove a whole income stream for immigrant populations or make it very difficult for them to practice it. So the city's in the process of reviewing all of that stuff. In the meantime, street vending remains as lively as it always has been. In other words, not much has changed.
Just waiting for a style section writer to come out and discover it.
Yeah, exactly.
In LA, they eat on the streets.
It's remarkable. And not just hot dogs, but here in LA, we have bacon dogs.
Oh, yeah. This is a completo of Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's the bacon dog is a hot dog wrapped in bacon. Like the bacon strip is wrapped around the dog and then cooked usually on like a metal tray on a laundry that is essentially one of those metal laundry baskets.
Oh, nice.
Like, it's this whole MacGyver
with the big flag
setup.
Pole.
Not even. It's usually just the cart, and then there's onions and peppers, and you get, like, you can get hot sauce and ketchup and mustard, and it's total, like, drunk people food, like you come out of some club. There's a lot of them that, you know, sell around Hollywood Boulevard. My cousin got her citizenship recently, and I went to the ceremony at the LA Convention Center, and you come out of the convention center, and there are stalls by both political parties where you can register to vote, and then there's bacon dogs. Last year I went to the Oscars. I covered it as part of a story I was doing, and when I left the Oscars, I decided that rather than taking a car out of the Oscars, I would walk on Hollywood Boulevard East until I hit something, because there's a whole security cordon that goes on around the Oscars and it shuts down all the blocks. And so I just kept walking on Hollywood Boulevard.
In your ball gown.
I actually was not wearing a ball gown. I just wore this black thing and I figured nobody will even know better since I sit in the nosebleed. And I just kept walking until the security cordon came to an end. And on the other end of that security cordon on Hollywood Boulevard was a lady selling bacon dogs. And a guy who tried to sell me some hot Nikes. So it's just like, God bless Los Angeles. You can leave the Oscars, roam the streets, have a bacon dog, and pick up some hot Nikes.
It's the full LA. It's the full red carpet experience.
It's the full red carpet experience. And so like the bacon dog is kind of a big LA, you know, beyond the taco truck and that kind of thing. It's like the bacon dog is a very important drunk people staple.
important drunk people word to the world is Jesus. So. I mean, we had a very appropriately sized mimosa here.
Yeah.
But I kind of wish that I was drunk and I could just go and just find go a, get bacon a bacon dog.
At this hour, it would be kind of hard.
They
really come out in the evening hours.
Well, they should stand outside the Tattletale at 11 a.m. sell drunk food. They would do a brisk business out there.
I know. Or the DMV. Those lines.
Let me ask you the thing that I think you're most, I don't know how your brain is partitioned right now, but it feels like a large part of your intellectual, personal, professional mind is on this incredible process that I think journalists all around the country are watching right now of finalizing the unionization of the Los Angeles Times, one of the great papers in our country's history, is finally going union. One of the great union busting papers, like a real historical enemy of
anti-union
of working people.
General Otis was no lover of unions.
So tell me, and didn't they get, they got firebombed?
Yeah, I think it was it 1910 or 1912? The date is muddled in my mimosa-addled brain. yeah, the LA Times was so anti-union that it was bombed in 1910s. And something like 17 people died. Jesus. It was bombed at night. Yeah, it was really tragic. By these militants from these like steelworkers union that were going around bombing sites around the U.S. that were anti-union sites. But the LA Times was just known for being vitriolically anti-union. Not only did General Otis not want a union at his newspaper, any business in Los Angeles that allowed unions would find itself on the receiving end of all kinds of invective in the pages of the Los Angeles Times. Like, he really saw LA as this place where entrepreneurs could come and open their businesses, and it would be like anti-union, and it would be like a businessman's paradise. And it would also, interestingly, contain no minorities. They used to call it the Great White Spot. You know,
Los Angeles.
Yes, Los Angeles would be the Great White Spot. And so General Otis, who became the first serious publisher of the LA Times, because the LA Times was founded prior to him taking it on, was very anti-union. And that kind of set the tone for the LA Times, the 1960s, when Otis Chandler took over and it became a much more serious journalistic enterprise. You know, he started hiring real reporters and started questioning government and not being in the pocket of city leaders. And the LA Times really started to earn Pulitzers at that time. Even then, the LA Times had this very paternalistic attitude towards its employees. You know, oh, we're going to pay you well. We're going to take care of you. It was called the Velvet Coffin because it was where you went to kind of die. Like, once you went to work at the LA Times, you weren't going to leave. And part of that meant never joining a union.
That was the other side of the deal. Fortunately, there's no outright violence between management and workers now. But you saw even with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and their publisher went berserk in the newsroom and scared the dickens out of everybody there. And in part because there was like a pro-union.
Yeah, the union poster had been critical of him.
It's very real. It's a huge part of, I think, what journalists everywhere are thinking about. And it's on the mind as they try to get some protections. How did this last round start, and what's your role in it?
Well, the unionization effort started in 2016. And it was when we were still owned by the terribly named Tronk.
Tronk.
Which is Tribune Online Content, run by a bunch of despicable dude bros from Chicago. And what had happened was, it's like the LA Times had seen what papers everywhere had seen. It was just being killed by 1,000 cuts and, you know, continual layoffs, less resources, worker benefits, and not giving raises. Everything that you can think of that goes on at newspapers was happening at the LA Times. And, you know, they took away our accrued vacation, and it was almost like it had come on the waves of all these layoffs, and it was almost the straw that broke the camel's back, because the accrued vacation for a lot of LA Times employees, that accrued vacation became really valuable if you got laid off, because there were no protections and really no protections in place if you got laid off. So that little kitty of money, you know, reporters relied on it if they got canned, and the company took it away. And that ended up being the straw that broke the camel's back and started organizing. You know, it's like the company can do these things unilaterally. We have no say. We can't complain. Like, there's no way to fight back. And the famously anti-union LA Times established a union. I got involved several months in. There had been organizing because I work mostly from home. I'm sometimes not completely connected to what's happening in the newsroom. And so a few months in, I heard about it and I became involved and started helping organize sections of the calendar section. And then after the union got voted in, which was historic because not only was it the first big union establishing itself, I mean, we now are at over 400 members.
Wow.
It was at the historically anti-union LA Times. So it made headlines everywhere. It inspired unionization campaigns at other much smaller papers like in Wyoming and Montana. The Chicago Tribune announced its unionization efforts after we did. Orlando, like all of these newspapers have unionized in the wake of our thing. And then now we're negotiating our first contract, which is as joyous as you might imagine. Consists of 10-hour meetings with lawyers.
And you're part of the negotiation team.
I'm on the bargaining committee.
Bargaining committee. Mm-hmm. Why take that on, especially for journalists who are listening? Like, what is your responsibility in this kind of very internecine and sometimes backstabby world of writing and journalism? How do you decide to be a collectivist and put so much of your time into this effort?
Because I'm a masochist and didn't know better. You know, I think for me, it was a couple of things. It was one, the political climate. I'm a Latina in the age of Trump. And it's a moment in which the media has been under attack. You know, the fake news media, reporters have gotten hurt at events. Like, they've been attacked. You know, this National Guardsman who was recently busted and wanted to kill members of the media. And my feeling was, like, if I could help journalists protect themselves, that was something I could do. And
right.
That didn't interfere with my being a reporter. You know, there was no conflict of interest.
Right. And I mean, none of us can do anything about the shooting at the Capitol Gazette.
Exactly.
The murderous intent of so many against our trade. You know, it's interesting because it has been these kind of twin calamities where you have deep professional instability.
Combined with violence.
Yeah.
My feeling was, if I can help give journalists any modicum of protection, then that will be something I can do. It's a little bit like herding cats because, you know, writers are famously independent and little crabby about getting involved in group activities. You know, we were all the loners in high school. And so, you know, getting everybody to work together and run information is definitely a little insane. And there are days where I'm like, why am I doing this? But at the same time, I think people get it. And they knew that the state of our industry is dire, and they knew the state of our paper was dire, and that if we kept letting these executives do what they were doing, which was like death by a thousand cuts while remunerating themselves very handsomely. I mean, they were giving themselves, like, you know, Michael Farrow was got a $15 million bonus for quote unquote consulting.
Absolutely shocking. And
it's disgusting. It's,
in my most optimistic appraisal of what's happening around the country, I always think maybe there's something, it's so bad, it's cathartic.
Yes.
Like, it might actually call into action deeper structural reevaluation of how things go because it's just so venal. I mean,
it's pillage, you know. And so they were essentially pillaging the LA Times. Like, they sold our building out from under us, they laid people off, they did everything to sort of cut from us while paying themselves more than most newspaper. You know, he had a private plane. Like, what newspaper executive has a private plane? Like, give me a break.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not the only one. Alden Media has been another one that has, you know, they purposely go and invest in newspapers that own their buildings because then they know that they can sell all of that infrastructure out from under them and make money.
Yep.
It is just pure corporate pillage. And in the meantime, destabilizing a profession that is already unstable. And that, you know, I always remind people, like, it's the First Amendment. What we do is protected by the First Amendment. It's an important part of being a citizen. Having a civic space is people who look into what people in government and people in positions of power are doing. And are we always perfect at it or great at it? No, but, you know, it's like an attempt.
Yep.
So I think our union very much stems from that. And so in terms of the bargaining process, it has been very laborious. It's our first contract. And so first contracts are always the most difficult. And we have pushed for as much pay as, you know, we can wring out of our billionaire owner at this time, which could be more competitive. But it is a salary increase at a time in which a lot of journalists aren't seeing salary increases. So we have that to look forward to. You know, we have managed to land a diversity clause in the contract that requires the company to interview a wider range of people when they're casting like about for a job.
A Rooney Rule.
It's a total Rooney Rule for journalism. Because even though the LA Times has one of the best ratios of underrepresented minorities in the newsroom, I'd say it's less worse than other papers, but it certainly doesn't reflect the demographics of Los Angeles.
The white spot.
Yes.
It's hard to bleach out.
The great white spot is still there. And we have managed to include something like that, and the company has accepted it. And so that's great for us. Now, we still have some other things that we are working on. The company making a real land grab on intellectual property. They not only want to own the things we write for the LA Times, which of course they do, but they want to own things that might be tangentially connected to our beats. And so it would set an industry low, essentially, for
we were talking about this too in some of the great works like Lev Grossman's Magicians series that he did while he was a writer Time Magazine, and he's rightfully had a ton of success with, just would not be able to happen if you take all the IP from people who are on your staff.
And exactly.
No matter what they do or when they do it, he wrote that shit in his own time.
Exactly. And, unpaid. You know, it's exactly. worth
it. He should get to keep the spoils. It is, I have to say, just watching from New York, what is really exciting is to see the number of announcements of new positions, to see people like Gustavo Arellano and Peter Meehan and all of these people who I know can do so much in a situation like this, just be brought in. And it's fucking great. And it makes me root incredibly hard for the LA Times and get that shit on paper. get your pay locked in while the, you know, the trade winds are favorable. But they seem to be that way for now. And that's pretty exciting.
I recently went to a new employee orientation to talk a little bit about the union and what we do and what being involved means. And you know, I just had to step back like in the middle of it because there was like 20 employees in the room, including our new class of Met Pros, which is the diversity training program. I looked around and I literally had to stop and I said, you know, if you would have told me a year ago that I would be here in front of a room full of new hires talking about what the union does, I just wouldn't have believed you. And here we are. It really is moving. And I feel like all the blood, sweat, and tears and late nights reading contracts like are worth it.
That's awesome. Well, fucking get it done.
I will.
By the time this comes out, hopefully the contract will be locked in and negotiated and finished. And
God, I hope so, because I need a full night's sleep. I'm such a mess.
But thank you for hosting me, allowing me to record you.
Of course.
In your home, while you also have many important legal documents related to the union waiting for you. But LA is an incredible city. Doing LA with you, It brings it out that much more.
I always see it as a little chain. You start with one thing that leads you to the next, to the next, to the next. And it's kind of never ending. It's beautiful.
Next podcast episode, why the fuck am I still living in New York? Thanks, Carolina.
Thank you.
The Trip from Luminary Media and Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Taffy Mukanyadze is our editor and, like me, does not hate a well-timed mimosa. Emily Marinoff is our producer. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Now, for a word about Luminary Media, our bright new model home of the future. It's a platform for a diverse and amazing array of podcasts that will be yours, ad-free, if you sign up now. This show is going to remain free for the next month, but after that, it is all for subscribers, and I hope that you will stand up and be counted among the righteous. Go to luminary.link/trip to sign up today. That's luminary.link/trip to sign up. Next week, Chris Yenbamrong of Night Market, who drinks wine with me in a Silver Lake apartment that he seems to have rented just to hold his wine. Dude is living his best life. We talked about Thai cuisine, 80s Hollywood power lunches, and why Night Market is the restaurant for our times. We will meet you there.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.